Hello and welcome to another edition of The Culture Bunker. I'm Andrew Harrison.
And I'm Sian Pattenden. Welcome to the first of two end-of-year editions, where we look back at the good stuff from the year and, of course, add the tunes to our ever-evolving Culture Bunker playlist.
This week we've got two special guests. Queen of Northwest Cosmicia Rock Pop, Jane Weaver, made one of our favourite records of the year, Flock, and she's here to tell us about her year and to choose some of her favourite records, films and other stuff.
And a veteran guest from our misty past. It's journalist, DJ and expert in very expensive men's jumpers. It's Anthony Teasdale. He'll be joining us to big up some of his favourites too.
Plus, because it's Christmas, officially, we've got a Christmas quiz for you. Recovering record shop godfather and author of the brand new official Christmas number one singles book, Michael Mulligan, has put together a fiendish pop quiz. Death to Lad Baby and the X Factor winner. We're talking about proper Christmas hits here.
All this and more on a snow-covered Culture Bunker. December will be magic again. After your couple of weeks off, Andrew, we've missed you on the Geek Desk, so we need some rapid reactions so the listeners can update their spreadsheets. The Eternals.
Rubbish.
What was that like?
Rubbish. Boring, pretentious, no sense of cosmic at all. Terrible. Worst Marvel movie ever.
Your thoughts on Hawkeye?
I actually quite like it. The whole point of Hawkeye is that he's the least interesting, least powerful Avenger. He's the everyman, ordinary guy who hasn't got superpowers. So that's why I like it. I know last week you were all saying, this guy's not a Captain America. But that's why he's good, you see. That's why I like him.
And importantly, the current series of Doctor Who, Andrew.
Well, it's largely set in Liverpool, therefore it's the best series of Doctor Who there has ever been. And Sontarans invading Liverpool, as long as they just blow up St John's Centre, I think we can all agree that was a good deal. It's the best Doctor Who in ages, and she's really pulled it out of the bag for her final series, and Chibnall's pulled it out of the bag for his final few shows. So that's my geek update.
Okay, now we've cleared all that up, let's meet our guests. Anthony Teasdale is a DJ about town and editor of Umbrella Ella Ella magazine. Hello, Anthony.
Good morning. Well, is it good morning? Yeah, it's 4:15. Yes. Good morning to you all.
But they could be listening to it at any time, so it's good something or other.
Whatever it is, afternoon, morning or night, I'm here for you. Yeah, everything is fine. Thanks, Sean.
Now, I have the important questions here. What's your usual Christmas shopping routine, Anthony? Are you a last-minute Russian panic?
No, I'm incredibly organised. As I am allergic to clutter, I insist that, one, I only buy tokens, and two, I only receive tokens. So next time I might, I might cut out the middleman and buy myself a token and then put to Anthony from Mum.
And the true meaning.
So no battered boxes of Lawntheric.
No, because I always hated that, you know, that sort of the endless, like, boxes under the tree. I mean, I'm an only child. Yeah. Do you know what I mean? I'm an only child from divorced parents. So it's just like, it's just a faff. I don't need that. Just give each other money or tokens. Or crisps.
Yeah.
Right.
Or crisps.
Do you ever give people records? And is this a thing now for people, now that music is effectively free if you're on a streaming service?
No, I don't buy people records because everyone hates the music I like. Right. So if you like pretentious...
You'll be choosing some later. Yeah, you're going to try and persuade us, aren't you?
I don't know what I'm talking about. If people like, subtle Balearic European pop, then that's great. But most people don't. My mum, actually, 30 years ago... bought me a copy of Saint Etienne's Fox Base Alpha, and that was the last record that was bought for me as a present. And it was—I don't think you can top that. So no, I'm not going to do that anymore. But I will give recommendations.
Well, by strange coincidence, Anthony introduced me to the music of today's guest years ago. So when he says the music he recommends is rubbish, he's completely wrong. She just released her album, The Silver Globe, and I instantly loved it. Jane Weaver was born in Widnes, started a Britpop band called Kill Laura when she was at sixth form college, where she was managed by New Order's father figure, Rob Gretton. After excursions into folktronica and lo-fi DIY, she has blossomed to a brilliant navigator of cosmic inner and outer space with a sound that manages to combine Cam, Tangerine Dream, Joni Mitchell and the Radiophonic Workshop and yet still sound entirely like herself. She's here with us today. Hello, Jane. Thanks for coming in.
Hello. What a lovely introduction.
I am everybody's hype man. It's nice. Thanks for coming to the studio. It's nice to get out, isn't it, just into the outside world.
Yeah. Yes, it is.
So this has been a massive year for you. You've been threatening to break through for years, and it happened this year. Your album Flock became a Six Music staple. Was it weird that it should happen in a year when we couldn't actually get out and enjoy it?
Yes, totally. I mean, to release a record anyway when record shops weren't open, they were open online, but to not do any gigs or part of a campaign, not to tour, not to do any radio sessions. There's a whole bunch of stuff that you normally do in conjunction with releasing a record that I couldn't do. So it was a bit like the unknown. But I had put it back slightly in that I was kind of maybe waiting for things to get a little bit better, but they didn't. So I just went, oh, what the heck, you know. Just
my experience of the average jobbing pop star is they say, oh, God, we hate having to do the promo and schlepping around all the rest. I bet you don't hate it now. I bet you miss it now. You're stuck home with your cat and your cup of tea, pop stars.
Yeah, I mean, I still did a lot of stuff online. That was a bit on top because I had to just fire through all that, you know, like Q&As and online stuff and Zoom, a lot of Zoom stuff, which I didn't know what I was doing when I started. Like many people, it's like, what do I do? What should I put behind me?
Yes.
What makeup should I put on and should I put my glasses on? That kind of thing. But, you know, I'm used to it now. Everybody's used to it, aren't you?
Actually, I should imagine your Zoom background is like a vision of the multiverse or something like that, infinite fractals. We're going to talk more about the album after a track from it. This is The Revolution of Supervisions, which sounds like a Marvel movie that I'd go and see. There's some heavy Bowie fame action on here. Tell us about this tune.
I think that what I had in mind, I was actually listening to Hot Chocolate at the time.
Ooh.
And listening to... Is it You Sexy Thing? Just the guitar parts and some of that that stuff and how it was recorded and then, you know, making sure that I tried to replicate that kind of vibe, really. Mm. It's just a mix of stuff.
The Flock album is this massive mix of intergalactic synth, dream pop, glam, even funk is in there. I get the impression that this was brewing in your brain for quite a while, was it?
Yeah, it was, because I'd probably done quite a lot of more cosmic style records, you know, more synth-based stuff and, you know, sort of heavier stuff as well. And I just got to the point where it's like, when I'd done Modern Cosmology, I thought, what am I going to do next? And I'd also done a remix album, rework album of my own tunes as well. So I'd gone deep into this kind of soundscape of stuff. And then I thought, I just want to do some pop songs.
Yeah.
Just want to do some kind of uplifting, a bunch of songs where when I play them live, it's all bangers.
Mm.
But when I was writing it, I actually felt quite miserable.
Really?
So I was in this position where I was trying to write myself up constantly. So some of the lyrics are a bit cynical or miserable, but I just went with it. I just thought, I don't care. Just get me through it.
It's sonically very uplifting. And a lot of the lyrics are, I think, on the track we just heard, you look at yourself and see nothing. But hey, the tunes are up.
Yeah, exactly. But, you know, I just went with it.
I think I read somewhere that it was produced on a complicated diet of bygone Lebanese torch songs, 1980s Russian aerobics records and Australian punk.
Yeah, I mean, that's kind of true, really. It sounds like, you know, but at the time when I was recording, I was watching, just taking inspiration from anywhere. And obviously you go down this kind of rabbit hole of like YouTube videos.
Mm.
And one of them was like kind of Russian aerobics music. And it sounds exactly like you would expect.
Well, I don't know what I would expect. Describe to me Russian aerobics music.
It's like, you know, any kind of aerobics music from the 80s, but in Russian language.
Mm.
Very poppy, sort of their version of Western music, you know.
But very proletarian as well.
Oh, I think it's quite uplifting, a lot of it. It's quite poppy, so.
Are you surprised at the kind of, at the people that your music reaches? Because you're quite a unique thing in the pop firmament. What kind of people like Jane Weaver music?
Well, I would say when I released the Silver Globe, a few years ago, it's like 2014, there was just a lot of men in the crowd with carrier bags. And
that was me, actually.
So you guys. But it's kind of opened up a lot more now. There's a lot more, you know, it's a bit more diverse and young and old and people from different backgrounds, which I'm pleased about because I just thought I was, you know, obviously had loads of men following me. You know, it felt a bit weird, but no, it's good.
I mean, you are often sort of mentioned in connection with Stereolab, Delia Derbyshire, Kate Bush, all women or female-led acts. Do women who don't make straightforward pop get lumped together indiscriminately? You know, like, oh, she's like Kate Bush, the old women in rock special syndrome.
Yeah, that pigeonholing probably occurs more with women than with men. And yeah, anybody's a little bit edgy or a little bit on the cusp of something else, not just straight down the line pop. Yeah, you all group together. But I don't mind. I mean, Kate Bush is my first inspiration, so I'm quite happy to say I love Kate Bush in loads and loads of ways, you know.
Yeah. You don't often see a, in quotes, new artist who's been like 20 years in the making. You know, you've kind of like, this has been long in development. Well, 20 plus years in the making. Do you think it's benefited you that it's taken like a while to get here and you've done different avenues and you've tried different things and maybe got to understand yourself a bit more?
I think that through the, you know, being in bands from when I was like 16 and now I'm the wrong side of 40, then...
Or are you the right side of 40,
exactly,
as I would call it?
Exactly, who cares? But I think that I've been through many situations. I've been in so many different bands. I've been, you know, recorded with loads of different people along the way. And I've sort of developed a way that I work in the studio, and that's where I prefer to be, really. Mm. I love going into the recording studio and developing and experimenting. And I've become more confident in that as I've grown older. And it's like, that's the thing I look forward to with age, how it's going to change, or maybe I'll just lose me marbles and it'll sound terrible. I don't know.
Are you saying the older you get, the more you think, wouldn't it be great to just not go out? Could that possibly be?
That, but I think there's also that thing where you do take no notice of the world outside once you get in your little zone, and it kind of frees up your mind to be more creative. I would say
this is the classic solo artist reaction of, what did you think of lockdown? I didn't really notice it. It was great. I just kept doing what I was doing anyway. I want to ask you, are you the most famous person from Widnes, do you think? Because I looked, and apart from Mel C, Alan Bleasdale, and a load of rugby players, it's you.
I'm really flattered. I never knew I was even noticed or included.
Can we talk about Witness for a second?
Let's talk about Witness. Can I get a Witness?
So I've got a mate of mine from Hale Wood, which is just...
This is relevant to all of our listeners, but many of them don't actually know where Witness is.
Right. So Witness is a town on the outskirts of Liverpool, and by all rights should be Scouse. Mm-hmm. Right? It's about as far out as where me and you are from. And yet, you cross this green, this like... What's it called? There's like a... Was it Hoff Green or something?
Hoff Green.
Hoff Green. And then, like, you go over half a mile, and they go from talking like that to what would be termed a South Lancastrian accent. And I'm weird. It's weird in the way that north of Liverpool it just spreads up, but there's this defining line. Yeah, it's like the rugby league border.
Mm. It's true. It's very. I went to school in Hoff Green, like when I was really little. And that was very... All my mates were very Scouse.
Right.
But I lived in, like, the north of Widnes. My parents were Scousers, but all my friends there, they were like, should we get some sweets? You know, more like a Manchester accent. And then all my mates were, you know... And dressed differently. There's a whole... It was like a massive boundary.
Tony Wilson always used to talk about the kind of unacknowledged psychedelic currents of the English Northwest.
Yes.
That, you know, that it's the most cosmic place in Britain, as is demonstrated, obviously, by you and me and Tony. It is the most kind of, it's an unacknowledged trend around there. Do you think there's truth in that?
I think there is. And I remember a few years ago doing a panel with, and I think Stuart McConey was hosting it, and it was me and Aid from Clinic, and we were sort of discussing... why, you know, maybe working out why it was. And I think my husband was saying something to do with the influx, the music, the records that used to come in, you know, obviously from the port, and the influx of American sort of new music, like psychedelic music. And I think Liverpool and Manchester probably got a good hit of that. Maybe it's from way back when.
I think it's longer. I think we're a crossroads in the country. We're sort of like halfway between Ireland, Scotland, North Wales and London. And we're this total melting pot. We're also incredibly Catholic as well. So my area, where me and Andrew are from, is nearly 50% Catholic. And I just think we're a bit different. And I think we've always been like that. It's a real big sky country. And anyone who should, you know, if you listen to this, you think, oh, do I want to go to Liverpool for the weekend? Go, because it's interesting and coastal and a bit weird. And we're soft. We're not like Yorkshire people who can be quite tough and quite grim up north. We're not like that. We're sort of, come in, have a cup of tea. We're softies.
This is Anthony painting the northwest of England as if it's the Joshua Tree or something. And the Charlotte's probably feeling quite excluded
bit,
now.
The south bit of the northwest of England.
Yeah. Jane, one of your tracks, Silver Cord, was sampled by Coldplay on their Ghost Stories album, which surprised me because I don't imagine them as really being so widely connected. Firstly, did you buy a mansion with the proceeds? Mm. Did you buy the Hall of Witness? And what was it like dealing with them? Does Chris Martin drive a hard bargain?
Do you want to know the story?
Go on, let's hear the story.
So apparently it was the keyboard player, the synth guy, who was doing loads of like sound beds for the record. And that's how he, you know, I became sampled in that. And then my old lawyer actually is the lawyer. And he rang me up and he said, are you sitting down? I've got some news. Coldplay have sampled you. And he's like, yeah, and Chris Martin wants to speak to you and, you know, wants your permission. And he was like, can you give me permission? I was like, Chris Martin rang me basically. He's like, hi, how you doing? I felt really bad for him because it was like a week after his divorce had been announced. So I was oh no, his lawyer's making him ring me, but he just doesn't want to do it. And he was really sweet and he was saying, you know, would you give us permission? I was like, well, I can't because I don't own the...
Really?
It was my husband's company who owned the master of it. So I was like, oh, you'll have to speak to them about it. But he was lovely. But no, I think I bought a new tumble dryer with the proceeds. Honestly, I was like, oh, a new tumble dryer.
It's the tumble dryer that Coldplay built.
Yeah.
Still
got it as well. Still going strong.
But you could probably sell that on eBay with some kind of Coldplay sensation. Yeah. Buy another tumble dryer and still have made money on the deal.
Yeah, exactly. So, yeah. And I went to see them, actually. They invited me to see them in Manchester. And I've never been to such a show. It was amazing. It was really like surrounded by people who were like punching the air and like really happy. I was like, oh my God, this is like... It was a bit like a Christian rock concert, but I really enjoyed it. And it was really, a massive spectacle, loads of like lasers and fireworks and all that kind of stuff.
Were you thinking, you don't do this at gigs?
I was just sat there trying to be cool. But I was surrounded by like, you know, the VIP, like football players and sort of wags and punching the air and having a great time, thinking it was like the best day of their life.
How the other half lives.
Exactly.
Did you go backstage?
I didn't realise, this is another part of the story, that my ticket was like this kind of VIP ticket to go spend time with the band's friend and family. And I just like rocked up at like 8 p.m. going, come on, let's go. And I'd missed all that. But I did go to the after show and a few of Coldplay were there. But I just said hi and walked away.
Was it good booze, good food, and you know, what's the ride, a good amount of crisps?
I can't remember. I think I just had two pints of cider and then
that's the spirit. Let's have another track from Flock before we pile into some of our favourite stuff from 2021. From the album, this track is called Sunset Dreams, summoning up a beautiful dusk over the River Dee, and yet it's got Hammer Horror in it. It has a dark side. Tell us about this one.
This was actually a collaboration, the only collaboration on the record, with my husband, who's called Andy Votel, and his background is like hip-hop music and he's a record collector. And he bought this French record from the 80s at Utrecht Record Fair, played it, and I was kind of writing something and it kind of fit with it. And I was like, I really want to use that sample. And he said, yeah, I need it for something else. I was like, oh no, please. And I was like literally begging him. I was like, I've written a really good song to it. So we had to get in touch with the artist. We ended up working on the song together. And that was that, you know. So I suppose it's more, somebody said to me, it's a bit hip hop and it's not your thing really. And I was like, yeah, but I'm just going with it. I love, you know, what's happened with it.
Did you have to say to Andy, look, let me have it and I will empty Coldplay's tumble try this one?
I did have to bargain with him, yes.
Good Lord. Let's have a listen. This is Sunset Dreams.
In my head.
And so to our favourites of the year. Jane, Anthony Teasdale and I will get to choose ours this week. Andrew gets his chance in 2 weeks' time, so we get first dibs. As regular listeners know, we can't clear all the music we want to, but we do put all of it on the rolling playlist, the very first link in the show notes on your app. We're going to kick off with our favourite albums of the year, and here's a track from Jane's. This is the Berlin-based British-German musician Anika, not of Japanese boy fame, the other one. This is the title track of her album Change, Jane Weaver's favourite record of the year.
Jane, tell us about Anika and Change. Who is she? What's she all about? And why do you like it?
I came across Anika, I don't know whether that's how you say it, a few years ago, the record Exploded View. She's got a band called Exploded View, and I think it was recorded in Mexico or something, and she's on Invader Records, which is a great label.
Mm. That's Jeff Barrow from Portishead, isn't
yeah.
it?
Yeah, so anything they release, it kind of, you know, makes me listen, really. But this is her first release in a while. I don't know, it's just got all of the production of it and the sounds of it and the way her voice is very, it is very Nico-esque. It's very sort of spoken word, and she's beautiful, and it's just kind of like, I just think it's a great record.
It's really sensual, and I mean, you know, Germanic experimental synth pop with a slightly
Thank
bored
you.
Lady on it. I mean, yeah, I sent it to Tony and Sean. Yeah. And I said, it's right up your street. It sounds like Nico fronting Stereo Lab. And he replies and said, Stereo Lab sound like Nico fronting Stereo Lab. But it is, yeah. She's kind of doing a modern iteration of that thing, isn't she?
Yeah, I guess. But then she's still her own, you know, unique person. Mm. I suppose I'm gutted because her tour's just moved to next year. I was supposed to go and see her next week. And I was like, I had my tickets like the moment they came out, but she's moved over to next year now. So
there's quite an edge to it as well, isn't it? There's one of the lyrics, I always give my man the last word, I always give him what he deserves. Don't forget that little twist of cyanide in his little gift. It's kind of, you know, there is, it's got the dark side to it.
Yeah, I think she has got that about her. I mean, I've only heard a few things she's done, and the Exploded View record, that's a bit darker and edgier, I guess.
Anthony Teasdale, in a wild shocker, we asked you your favourite record of the year and it turned out to be Jane's own album, you big creep.
Ah, oh, thank you.
So, come on, why? Why did you? I mean, obviously,
because I like music like this, and it's really unsurprising that I like it because I was a big fan of the Silver Globe. And I like it because I like spacey cosmic disco rock fronted by excellent ladies.
Oh.
And but what did I say about it? I would say I really liked Sunset Dreams, and I would I'd really recommend that, even if you don't listen to the whole album, listen to that. And I described it as like, it felt like a dreamy revenge song.
Yeah. Yeah, you're right. It is that kind of thing, but it's, you know, it's fictional. It's not.
Oh, right. Okay.
A little bit of facts in there.
Is there any background to that? Because I thought it was interesting. I was like, who's this?
It's really weird you're asking me this. My son was asking me yesterday in the car. He was like, are your songs, what are they about? Who are they about? And I was like, they're just they're a faction of stuff. They're a mixture of things that have happened and haven't happened and stuff I embellish on, or somebody has annoyed me and I'm just going, ha-ha, I'm going to write about that. I'm going to get my own back, but you will never know because it's disguised.
Watch out for the new track, Annoying Podcaster, coming on the next Jane Weaver album.
I would also say that it's got a great opener, and I think it's really important that an album starts with a great opening track. And it's Heartlow, and it's brill, and it comes in slowly and then bangs in, and it's like, you just know it's going to be a boss record, like from the start. So
thank you.
I remember you running up to me in a magazine office in 2014 or wherever it was, going, you've got to listen to this, Silver Globe is right up your street. How did you discover this one?
I think it's either through an algorithm on Spotify.
Mm-hmm.
Because all the records I like, are like Jane's music. So, here you go. But also, I'd also say things like Facebook is really great for this. And I think I hear a lot of great music now through Facebook, rather than like, say, 5 years ago when it was all terrible politics. You can really enjoy Facebook in times. And I think I've heard it from that, and just heard your name on the, you know, on the virtual grapevine, and thought,
Yeah.
Grapevine and thought, yeah.
Facebook, not just for destroying society then.
No, no, it has other uses.
It has other uses. Sean Patton, you couldn't decide and you went for two albums of the year, didn't you?
I know, and two's not enough. And I would say props to Jane. I've been re-listening to your album all week as well because I love it too. So
oh,
I want to get
thank
in there too. It's so great.
Didn't want to be the odd one out. So what are the ones that you've chosen is Dry Cleaning and their album New Long Leg. Remind the listeners who they are and why you love them because we talked about this earlier in the year, didn't we?
We certainly did. Dry Cleaning are from the coast. They are Florence Shaw, who is the singer, but she's very much a spoken word singer. And they are three blokes at the back who do this fantastic three blokes at the back. Can we use the word angular? But there is a little bit of angular wire style guitar and backing definitely going on there. And what just really, really brings it out and sort of makes it so sharp and focused and funny and unique is Florence Shaw's worldview and the lyrics that she has. The album starts with Scratch Card Lanyard, which I think was at least two people's choices of 2020, because the single came out then. They are so funny. You pick up things that you haven't heard, you know, on eight listens. The ninth one will give you something else. And I saw them live. This is the most exciting thing. We might be talking about this later as well. I saw them live only a few days ago and I've been waiting so long. And it was just absolutely fantastic. I just find there's more and more in them. And that's when a band is really good, don't you think?
Yeah, it's also very funny. That's a very, very dry sense of humour.
But it's odd. She's odd and she plays on it. It's very askew. There's lots of things about, there's half-eaten Kit Kats in a bag all the time and hot dogs and stuff like that. There's really wry things. And there are wonderful lines in it that Florence Shaw does say. There is a point where there is a line that's so nihilistic, do everything, feel nothing. And you actually realise it's taken from a Tampax advert.
We may have other leg-related woman pop later in the show, possible spoilers. There's been an almost total absence of four male Herberts with guitars this year. Do you think, Sean, it's a year of triumph for Women in Rock TM, Women in Rock Special?
Oh, you used it. Yeah.
That's what I used it.
I'm going to say yeah, because lots of music I've liked this year, I realised was female-fronted or has a vast majority of females in the band. It's been really exciting. I also do think, and I'm saying this sincerely, like Smashy and Nancy, it's been an amazing year for music. I think we have been spoilt. And it's just so glorious that people are breaking out of that box and that four skinny white boy template seems to be fairly absent this year.
Well, as a no longer skinny white boy, I might have my own perspective on that one. Your other choice is, of course, the love of your life and future husband, Tyler, the Creator, with his album Call Me If You Get Lost. You like him a lot, don't you?
I do like him a lot. You know that. There's stickers of him everywhere on all my gadgets. Tyler, the Creator, is, of course, one of the members of the enormous rap crew Odd Future, who were around the noughts and spawned lots of people like Frank Ocean and Earl Sweatshirt and stuff. Tyler is both mainstream and bizarre. He falls in love with boys and girls, and he's going to tell you all about it on the records. The records go from being completely melodic to really quite hard hip hop and that very Californian West Coast real. I mean, you know, he is for real. He is telling it you for real, and there's a lot of info on there. But he always records concept albums. So the one before this, Igor, was him in a blonde wig looking like this sort of bastardised gay Andy Warhol black man who was both a soul singer and a hip-hop artist who was going to sort of beat you up in the alley afterwards. I didn't agree with him. And this one is far more soul. It's a lot poppier. It's about escaping. There's lots of references to Europe. He plays a preppy boy in this almost and that sort of thing. It's very Gucci. It's very nail varnish. And I just absolutely lovely. And Wilshire, I think, is one of, you know, the last track on it is one of my tracks of the year as well. I mean, that was quite played on a streaming service when I looked at the Unwrapped thing.
Well, we're going to stick that on the playlist. So we'll have stuff from all of these albums on our rolling playlist.
Sleigh bells ring. Are you listening? In the lane, pop hits and annual royalties in perpetuity are glistening. We're delighted to welcome Michael Mulligan, author of the official Christmas number one singles book. It's a must for any Christmas stocking if you like seasonal music, stats, pop history and fun facts. Hello, Michael. How are you?
Ho, ho, ho. Hello.
Welcome to the show. You have a quiz for us, we believe. But first, I wanted to ask you a couple of questions about Christmas number ones.
Please do.
You must have thought about this extensively. I'm sure that's an understatement. What makes a Christmas single?
It's a bizarre thing. Obviously, there's the usual sleigh bells, holly, jolly, etc., etc. There's the point you touched on earlier that what motivates a musician to make a Christmas single? Is it royalties? Is it going down in history? Is it they just feel festive? I really don't know. And then there's the reason, why did the great British public buy them as well? Because when you look at the records that got to number one, and perhaps more pertinently, the records they beat. So, you know, St Winifred School Choir are knocking Culture Club and Adam and the Ants and the Police and ABBA and Queen and everyone else into a cocked hat. And record companies are spending a fortune and a lot of time and skill and effort to market their big hitters for the fourth quarter of the year when all the revenue is there. And the great British public turns around and says, no, I'll have a school choir, thanks very much.
Yeah. When does the Christmas number one become a thing historically? We have, obviously, you know, the early stuff is Frankie Lane, Winifred Atwell, Johnny Ray. Yes. But when is it that, you know, it's there's a kudos in having a Christmas number one single?
There is. And actually, the first Christmas number one was also the first number one because the NME started in started the chart in November 52. And Al Martino, their first number one, just hung on in there for 12 weeks and became the first Christmas number one as well. So, yeah.
The Ed Sheeran of his day, one might say.
Yet to make a single with Elton John, but yeah, very much so. So, you know, it is from the off, but I don't know. I presume at some point in the 70s that the bookies started taking odds on it. That seems to be, right, you know, part of the tradition now.
How many new facts and statistics did you unearth while writing this book? And what was the most surprising?
Countless, more than I could fit in. And I could bore you senseless with tinsel trivia.
We want the interesting ones.
Okay, here we go. Queen, Bohemian Rhapsody. Mm-hmm. So Christmas number one twice. But by dint of it being still number one in the new year, the only record to be number one in four separate years.
Right.
Queen Bohemian Rhapsody Part 2 doesn't mention the words Bohemian or Rhapsody in the lyrics of the song, but mentions the title of the song that knocked it off number one first time round.
Oh, wow. That is a fact.
Pause for effect. Mamma Mia by ABBA.
Wow.
Oh, spooky.
Mamma Mia, Let Me Go.
Mamma Mia knocked Bohemian Rhapsody off number one. So you come up with things like that, and then you start adding up how many number ones did the artists who appeared on Band Aid have between them? So I sort of went down those little rabbit holes as well.
And it's quite a lot, isn't it?
It was 25, I think, and Sting with the Police was four of them, and Paul Weller was four of them with the Jam as well. So, yeah, I like disappearing down those rabbit holes.
Andrew thinks that TV talent shows ruined the Christmas number one because from pop stars onward, it became the thing. But it was streaming, right? What do you think about this? From the 2000s onwards, what happens to the Christmas number one?
Let's just take a step back. So you think of the investment in buying or accessing or procuring a Christmas number one. So right back at the very beginning, you've got to spend 2 years' salary on a gramophone player the size of a wardrobe. And then you've got to go to a department store where a snooty man says, "Can I help you, madam?" And you've got to invest in a 78 RPM record to play on this big gramophone. There's an awful lot of record. And now you just kick back and your voice-activated speaker and you say, "Play me Christmas music." There, you know, how much emotional investment is there there? So it's come from one extreme to the other. And actually, because all of those streams that you never chose in the first place, they're someone else's curated playlist, but they all count to the chart. So actually, you're passively contributing to the chart rather than actively. And that sits rather uncomfortably with me. But yes, going back to, you know, We started the chart with the Tin Pan Alley A&R time when artist and repertoire was a person marrying a singer with a song. And then we went through it all again with the X Factor year. So, you know, it was nothing new.
I mean, one of my favourite facts in the book, and there are a few, is that households that were lucky enough to own a television in the 50s would spend £85 on a really small set. That's the equivalent of £2,400 today.
Yeah, and, you know, you can pick up a phone in your supermarket and be listening to music 5 minutes later. Yeah. Where's the effort there, pathetic kids of today?
Describe the phenomenon of Lad Baby, because there are three Christmas number ones. Am I right?
You are right. There are three, and they did say at the time, "That's it, we're done." And then they hinted at a fourth. They have a perfectly formed chart career. So they made three records and all three went to number one, and that is it.
And it's for charity as well. And I think that you seem to say in the book that makes a difference, that it is more led towards charity donation than number one.
Band-Aid, Do They Know It's Christmas was actually the first charity number one single in 84. And there's been about 50 since. And, you know, we all get the rosy glow. And Christmas is inescapable because department stores and shops that wouldn't normally think of playing music insist on playing music to you at Christmas just to make you part with your money. I don't think it's any coincidence that Wizard, I Wish It Could Be Christmas Every Day, starts with the sound of a cash register. They knew all about it. But yes, you know, we all get this rosy glow at Christmas and we think of others. And, you know, some good has come of it. Lad Baby was Trussell Trust, the food banks. And, you know, I wonder how many people said, yes, I'm going to download stream that track to support Trussell Trust, and have never listened to it since. You know, that was their investment. It was that moment, and they never want to hear it again. Thank you very much.
Lastly, where does the Christmas single go from here? And were Christmas number one?
This morning they announced the new Ed Sheeran, Elton John collaboration. It has everything. So two artists with 19 number ones between them. It has sleigh bells. It has church bells. It has a children's choir. It has a video that features tinsel and snow, celebrities mocking themselves. It makes references to previous Christmas videos. So, yes, there's a sausage roll in it. And... but it's the charity angle. So, but will the great British public turn around once again and go, no, 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 do you know what? We're going to go for some death metal, actually. We've had enough of you. So it is wonderfully unpredictable. And that is the joy of it. And long may it continue.
Right, Michael's book, the official Christmas number one singles book, is out now. And he has prepared for us a quiz about Christmas pop. He's going to ask the questions, and then later in the show, there will be the answers. So get your pens and papers out, or at least just make a note in your app on your phone, whatever you like. Michael, take it away with the questions.
Question one. The male singer who had the 1956 Christmas number one received a name check in the opening line of the best-selling single of 1982. Who was he? And what was that single? Question two. Which Liverpool act had two singles in the Christmas 1965 top 10, including that year's best-selling single in the UK? Question three. Years before the department store started having an influence on the Christmas chart race, how was John Lewis responsible for the 1980 Christmas number three? Question four. The label of which 70s Christmas hit and perennial festive favourite features a credit that reads Additional Noises, Miss Snob and Class 3C. Question 5. Which Christmas number one artist recorded a duet version of Crocodile Rock with Elton John for inclusion on his 2001 debut album? Question 6. Three different versions of Do They Know It's Christmas have been number one for Band-Aid in 84, Band-Aid 2 in 89, and Band-Aid 20 in 2004. But who sang the opening line on each version?
Hope you've been listening carefully there. I've got the answers in front of me, and I couldn't believe the answers to some of these. So we'll have them at the end of the podcast when Michael will return. Time for the best TV and film of the year, as chosen by our panel. Who's gone for what? And why do they keep choosing so many films that aren't in English, so the trailer sounds strange? Here is a taster of the choices of Tony T, Jane Weaver and Sean.
Réponds-moi direct. Est-ce que je peux t'appeler n'importe quel jour de la semaine à 4h du matin?
Oui.
Tu peux commencer tout de suite?
Donc chaque agent a en moyenne 80 comédiens. On les aide à trouver des rôles, on négocie leurs contrats.
On en est où de Cécile de France pour les Tarantino?
Noémie, passez-moi le contrat de Guillaume Canet, s'il vous plaît.
Voilà, tout de suite. On les accompagne dans la gestion de leur carrière. En échange, on prend 10% de la rémunération.
Qui est parti, concrètement?
Berléand.
Qui a frappé l'autre?
Berléand.
Ringo said that he thought we ought to just tell it like it is.
We have to do a show at the end of it.
From director Peter Jackson.
We should do the show in a place we're not allowed to do it.
Experience the three-part event.
Getting forcibly ejected.
Featuring footage that's never been seen.
I mean, that is an insane photo of you all being beaten up.
Until now.
Okay, I'm rolling.
One, two, three, four.
Almost
Det er lidt højere.
Så vi skifter gear.
Er I fuld?
Nej, det er vi ikke.
Hvorfor klarer du for børnene, hvad som er hent?
Jeg er blevet lidt fuld i morgen.
Jeg har hele tiden synes, det var fint, at I eksperimenterede alt muligt, men det her, det er ordentligt.
Jeg går ikke ud fra, at der er nogen her, der har et problem, jeg skal vide noget om.
Anthony Teasdale, you chose Call My Agent, like the massive Europhile elitist that you are. What was so great about this story of Parisian talent agents in the TV and movie game? Because we all watched the hell out of it this year, didn't we?
Oh, yeah. I mean, I'm a despicable person, so it's not surprising that I'd choose something like this. But I was looking, when you sent me the question through, I thought, well, you know, did I go for Squid Game? Which, and I just thought, well, that's a bit obvious. So I looked through my diary, because I keep a diary, and I was like, all my January and February is Call My Agent. There's nothing else in my life except Call My Agent.
Right.
And if you've not watched it, I insist you do. So what's so great about it is, so it's about a showbiz agency in Paris. They're all slightly schemey. And the talent agency ASK, which is Agence Samuel Guerre. In each episode, it's sort of self-contained, and they're always based around a French star, which is so strange because mostly you've never seen them, and yet you know that this person, you know, is famous in France and was probably in Delicatessen. There are two or three really central characters. There's Andrea, who is played by Camille Cotin, and she is a go-getting, hard-nosed agent who makes loads of terrible life decisions. It's basically, there are long story arcs about, you know, the agency getting taken over, but mostly it's about the unreasonable desires of famous people. And it's absolutely hilarious. And it's also a really good picture of what modern France is like. Not, you know, the France, you know, that you did in Trickle or, you know, school, like, which is about La Rochelle.
Yeah,
and Monsieur Leclerc. It's about modern day France, which I really like. So the women call each other Meuf. Or Nana,
yeah,
and blokes are called Mech. Do you know this?
I didn't know this.
This is French for lad.
French is Mech is lad or bloke.
Yeah,
Meuf is like the female equivalent, and then if they see each other, they call each other Nana.
Ah, right.
So I like a bit of the old French slang in there as well, Verlan as it's called. So yeah, it's incredibly entertaining. Four series to really get through, and it's a right laugh. It's dead easy.
Mm-hmm.
And I think my favourite character is Naomi. Do you
Naomi? Remember? Naomi the PA.
Yeah.
Of the terrible self-aggrandizing guy who figures himself to be the boss agent. She's fantastic.
But she was great. But she was always taking her clothes off, wasn't she?
Yeah. There was she started as like being you think like a typical office busybody, but then she goes into this incredibly passionate love affair tricks, and she's amazing.
So the conceit, as you say, is that real actors play themselves, and they also mock themselves. A little bit like extras here, but I think better. I want to ask both of you who was your favourite cameo in this fantastic. I mean, I loved Monica Bellucci because she was mocking her own kind of sex symbol status in a really clever way and showing a sense of humour about herself. And Charlotte Gainsbourg because she was just so funny. I had no idea that she was such a good comic actor. What did you think, Jane?
Well, I liked Beatrice Dahl.
Yes.
She was good. Yeah. And there's another French actress who was taking the mickey out of herself. I can't remember her name.
Cécile LaFrance, is she called?
Yes. Cécile LaFrance. That was a good episode.
Yeah.
She wanted to do a comedy sketch. She wanted to become a comedian, didn't she?
Yeah.
And she was really lame.
I actually felt it ended too soon. I could have watched another two series.
Yeah,
do not
definitely.
Worry.
Oh, it's coming back.
Because according to London's Wikipedia site...
Oh, right. It's coming back.
Yeah,
oh,
there's going to be a 90-minute TV special
and an
extra series. We need never leave the house
Fantastic.
Again.
That's it. Well, something to look forward to. Jane, your choice, because somebody has to, by law, is The Beatles Get Back. Have you done all 8 hours?
I've done most of it, yeah. So I've kind of like been watching it and then walked away and then come back to it. But I've done most of it, yeah. I've done most of it in now.
People have seen this and reactions have been quite, in some cases, quite violent. You know, I can't, you know, it's so moving. Others have treated it like a beautiful warm bath of Beatledom. What was your own take?
It's just absolute joy. It's like a gift dumped before Christmas. It's just like, there you go, everyone, have that. And for somebody like me who's, I mean, I'm not like, I don't know the ins and outs of everything to do with the Beatles. I haven't got loads of books. I haven't read intrinsically about everything they've done. I'm just a fan. You know, I love Abbey Road. I love going to Abbey Road. I love like anything like that. And I just think it's nice to see them at work in a way that I never expected. It's quite a surprise that the way that they worked. I never knew really that, even though Paul, I anticipated he wrote most of the songs in that way, to actually see it playing out was just amazing. Mm. And the way all the different characters. And another thing, I really love Ringo. I never knew.
Yeah.
I say I've got a real hot crush on Ringo.
Well, the real surprise has been how this has basically flipped pretty much everybody's opinions about most of the people in the Beatles. Ringo, we should stop talking about the patience of Job and start talking about the patience of Ringo, because he can put up with everything. Yoko, who, is, as we know, has been subject of misogynist racist abuse for decades, comes out of it with a lot of dignity and comes out of it as really being the kind of rock that Lennon needs.
Yeah, yeah.
George comes out of it having a bit of a dick at parts, I thought.
He does, a bit moody. But then again, I did read a number of years ago Patty Boyd's book called Wonderful Today, and that's a bit of a sort of insight around this time in some of the book, and then her ongoing relationship with Eric Clapton. So I think that's the only kind of Beatlesy book I've kind of read. Yeah. But it's really interesting.
The thing that surprised me was how differently they behave from the way that people, not just musicians and creative people, everybody behaves on television now. I've had so many years of being acculturated by the television they watch that when a camera's on them, they behave differently. And the Beatles are behaving, although they are at that point the most famous people on the planet and approaching the status of demigods, they behave more naturally than the average person would if grabbed for a Vox Pop at the end of the street. Yeah. And it just feels like a different time, a different way of looking at the world.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, they are really natural. Maybe they just have got so famous that they just don't care. Mm. You know, maybe they know the value and they just are not bothered about the outside world. They're quite happy within their bubble.
I thought that they really appeared like four scousers in an office. And I know that sounds... It just reminded me of just four fellas in an office. I know that sounds absolutely mental, but they were just four blokes in an office. Mm. And you're getting this vibe. They've worked together for years. They've just turned up for work, which I quite like. And I think in the 90s, it was cool to say that McCartney was a bit of a beaut. But
you'll have to translate that to the regular listeners.
That McCartney was a bit naff. Mm. But it's him who's driving it. He's absolutely essential to it. And without him, that people think, oh, he's not very cool. I think he's really cool because he's got that massive, he's got a real work ethic. He's an old school showbiz grafter. Mm. We're going to do this. You know, there's this amazing scene, I think you've probably seen it on YouTube, where he comes up with Get Back in 2 minutes.
He's
just playing his bass. And he hasn't got the vocals sorted yet. And over 2 minutes, Get Back has been written.
Well, so much of it is an exercise in dramatic irony because we know so much that they don't. And Lennon's wandering around and he's going, hang on, he's just making up Jealous Guy there, but it's got different words.
Yes.
Pay attention. Oh, my God. I mean, I'm a lot sort of...
Oh, yeah, that fit,
I'm a lot cooler on the Beatles than some people. I'm not sort of like live, eat, breathe the Beatles like certainly the guests we've had on the show. But to me, it was like, this is something that's probably going to be watched in a couple of hundred years' time. It's the equivalent of being able to watch Beethoven or Mozart at work. It's also a bit like watching a stegosaurus. It's like watching a piece of history before your very eyes. And even if you're not, like, fully bought in, personally, if you cut them, they bleed Beatles, it's still actually quite fascinating.
Yeah, I mean, I can't understand. There's been a few people on Twitter, I'm quite surprised, who don't really get it, who are like musicians or they don't like it and they're just like, nah, it's not great, or they're not enjoying watching it. I just think, how can you not enjoy? I know it's a bit arduous getting through it, but there's so many amazing, joyful moments in it. How can you not recognise it? I'm just like, it's brilliant. Even like, you know, Mal, the roadie and all that. It's just like, just seeing their little faces around. It's just,
And Glenn Johns' outfit. Johns' mad coat. How can one band eat so much toast? So much
tea toast. And toast.
Tea and toast. Tea. He never gets to do that gig like in the the Roman Amphitheatre. No. He was pushing it, does it?
No, yeah, exactly. Yeah,
that guy's that, yeah. Damn,
terrible.
Not doing that, laugh.
He's like, I don't want to go anywhere.
Sean, yeah, for your film of the year, you've chosen Another Round, the amazing Mads Mikkelsen movie in which a teacher in midlife crisis decides to medicate with booze. Remind the listeners of what it's about and why it's so great.
It's a film by Thomas Vinterberg. It is about the theory that was proposed by, is it Skarsgård? That we have actually too little alcohol in our bloodstream and mammals need 0.5. 0.5, I'm not a scientist, as you can tell, whatever it is per millilitres, to actually truly function properly. And so a group of very bored and very disillusioned teachers start an experiment to keep their blood alcohol at that level while they are teaching and see if it proves good for them, but also good for the students who are clearly very, very bored in the film of the way they're teaching and are at the point of complaining with their parents. So we're not going to get through the exams. Your teaching is so bad. And any film that starts with a quote from Kierkegaard is all right with me. It starts, what is youth? A dream. What is love? The dream's content. And it explores the idea of hedonism, of boredom, of what we are here for. From a very slight idea, there is so much about the human condition and so much about friendship and life. And our connection to each other that is just glorious. And it is one of those films that I think I've watched 3 times and I could easily watch a few more times at Christmas, which I probably will do, because there's so much to get out of it. And I absolutely adore it.
We're coming to the end of the podcast. So before we get to the quiz answers, let's have some actual individual tunes. Our panel are going to choose the ones that got away, the tracks that should have been bigger, and then their actual big tune of the year. It is, of course, a clearance minefield, so we can't play all of them. Well, in fact, we can only play one of them. But we're going to put all the tracks on the rolling playlist. Let's listen to Jane's one that got away. This is Lema with Disco Pregnancy, open brackets, tonal and rhythmical, close brackets.
Love, wait. Yeah, body me, time, love me, fear, body weight, chances of, no return, suit yourself, let it burn, wait for me.
So, Jane, your one that got away is Lema, Disco Pregnancy. This is on Soul Wax's label, D-Wee. What is this all about? And have you experienced a disco pregnancy?
Yes, I have. I have DJed whilst being heavily pregnant.
Nice one.
This track I came across because I was listening to Charlotte Ajigere, who's also on D-Wee, which is Soul Wax's label. And then I saw this video of this. Actually, you should check it out on YouTube. It's done by Douglas Hart and Steve Mackey. It's really good. But it's just a tune I missed. It's like, how did I do this? So I think she released it last year, but this new video's come out this year.
It's incredible. I thank you so much, Jane, for alerting us to some stuff I just hadn't heard. I think this is amazing, this track.
Oh, that's good. Yeah. It reminds me a bit of like Willpowers.
Yeah.
That kind of vibe.
Yeah.
Is it Lynn? I can't remember her name. The lady from Willpowers. It's that kind of spoken word thing.
Top stuff. Tony Teasdale, yours is on a completely different angle. Camélia Jordan with Facile. She's a French Algerian singer who won the X Factor. Couldn't be more different from Disco Pregnancy, or could it?
It's not that different. It's a really piece of beautiful French pop.
Yeah,
and it's because she came third on Nouvelle Star, which I think. And it's just incredibly catchy. And my GCSE French lets me know that facile means easy.
You're definitely on a French kick today, aren't you? It's been a very French year for you.
Well, the French always come up with really great things, don't they? They're inherently quite cool. I mean, not all of them. But, they just tend to produce really good culture. I'm a real sucker for a European language obscure pop record.
Well, that tune actually is very much the vibe of Call My Agent in pop music form. So very thematically consistent. Sean, you've gone for a track called Bite with two Ys by an artist called Spencer. It's on the album Are You Down? Tell us about this.
Spencer, cruelly overlooked, and partly that's a pandemic, I think. He's a hip-hop artist from Rochester, New York, but lives in Brooklyn now. It's the blend of, I say hip-hop, but there's R&B, funk, indie, pop, jazz, soul, melty bits, curious bits. He's on 4AD, and then suddenly it all makes sense. Some of it's backwards, some of it just seems to just droop and then come back again. I mean, what he does musically, I think, is really exciting. And he just hasn't had any traction because of been lacking the tour aspect of promotion of your record. So it's a real shame. I think the record's really, really good. And no one I know has heard it.
Well, they will now when the rolling playlist. Finally, then, before we finish, it's Song of the Year time. And to my amazement, Shauna's gone for Wet Leg with Chaise Long, All Day on the Chaise Long. Everybody loves this one. Shauna, why is it Single of the Year?
Oh, why isn't it Single of the Year? It's got more hooks than you can hang a coat on. It's by Wet Leg, who are two women who just have appeared from nowhere, and bar Tyler, the creator, may be the most amazing humans on the planet, and obviously Jane Weaver and Tony Teasdale and Andrew Harrison. They're just so full of wit and excitement and that silliness. You know when music can just be such a laugh, and yet it comes across as the most exciting punky lo-fi thing ever that you've seen in your life. I love them.
The liberating quality of well-milled foolishness.
Or even roughly milled.
Well, from the roughly milled to the extremely well-milled. Yeah, because Teasdale has gone for an ABBA track from the ABBA album. Keep an Eye on Dan. Tony Teasdale, what happened to House Bangers? I thought you lived in a 4/4 universe.
My whole life is House Bangers.
Yeah.
This came up on my YouTube Premium, and I thought, I am quite I'm an ABBA fan, but I'm a fan of individual records, and it came up, and I just thought that's really, really weird. But it's also really, really excellent. So it's quite like Visitors era ABBA. It's very synth pop, very disco-y, I would suggest. It's like a 1979 Angular Disco record. And best of all, the lyrics are about a woman dropping off her son with dad.
Yeah, with their ex-husband. Yeah.
And it's sort of very, for personal reasons, that sort of really resonated with me. And I just think it's absolutely brilliant. And the rest of the LP I'm not so keen on, but I think it's a genuinely fantastic record.
Yeah, this is the one I actually wish that this comeback record had been a bit more like that, bit more Summer Night City and a bit less Chiquitita.
Yes.
Because that's, I think, you know, the Visitors is the album everybody really likes, isn't it? Because it's the one that's got all that kind of rich synth aspect to it. I don't know.
Do you like this record? Have you heard it? It's brilliant.
I've not heard it all. I've heard bits. They were releasing a record, I nearly cried because I was going, oh my God, it's ABBA.
Yeah.
This track is really, it's a proper banger. And, you know, I might have to do a Deep House remix of it.
Well, the thing is, there's a line in the middle where she's talking about having dropped the kid off with the husband and banging her head on the steering wheel in frustration. And she just goes, and I bang. And I thought, he's going to snip that out and just loop it. And bang, I bang. Doof, bang. Doof, doof, doof. It's got Teasdale written all over it.
My latest boring EP.
Yes. Jane, finally, you get to use the last one. Yours is Lily by Richard Dawson and The Circle. Who are these guys?
So Circle are a Scandinavian... what would they be classed as, a psych or a prog band, maybe? And they've been going for a while. And then Richard Dawson, who's an amazing cult artist. And they have collaborated together and produced an amazing album, which it's just been released, literally last week. So, yeah, you've got to check it out. It's like a roast dinner. It's a big, big, rich thing to eat.
It's a big roast dinner. This particular tune is kind of bleak northern krautrock about death in hospital, with friend of the podcast Steve Davis playing snooker in the video.
Yes, how weird is
he that? Appears to be a supporter of the band. Yeah, Steve has very good musical taste. Well, we'll stick that one on the playlist, and now it's time for those Christmas quiz answers. It's time for the answers to that fiendishly difficult Christmas pop quiz that Michael Mulligan wrote for us. Michael, give us the question and then give us the answer.
So our first question asked, who was the male singer who had the Christmas number one in 1956 and then received a name check in the opening line of the best-selling single of 82? And the answer is, poor old Johnny Ray, who sounded sad upon the radio, broke a million hearts in mono. He was number one with Just Walking in the Rain and then in the opening line of Come On Eileen by Dexys Midnight Runners. Question two was about which Liverpool act had two singles in the Christmas 1965 top 10, including that year's best-selling single in the UK. Well, it's obvious, isn't it? Come on, best-selling in 1965. It was, of course, the Nabob of Nutty Ash, Mr. Ken Dodd.
So if you thought it was the Beatles, you were wrong.
Yeah, go to the back of the classroom. yeah, Ken was at number three and number five in the Christmas top 10 that year with The River and Tears. And Tears was the best-selling single of the UK in that year and the third best-selling single of the 60s.
Slightly kind of gives the light to the idea that the 60s was the Beatles and nothing but the Beatles, doesn't it?
Ah, no. Question three asked you, years before the department stores started having an influence on the Christmas chart race, how was John Lewis responsible for the 1980 Christmas number three? Well, John Lewis is the real name of Jonah Louie, who spent 5 weeks at number three in December 80, January 81, with Stop the Cavalry.
And you always find him in the kitchen at parties.
Oh, you will. We then asked you, the label of which 70s Christmas hit and perennial festive favourite features a credit that reads Additional Noises, Miss Snob and Class 3C. And the answer is I Wish It Could Be Christmas Every Day by Wizard, the one we mentioned earlier that starts with the sound of the cash register, Roy New. The full credit reads Vocal Backing by the Suedettes, plus the Stockland Green Bilateral School First Year Choir, Additional Noises, Miss Snob and Class 3C. And a bonus point, obviously, if you got all of those. The Christmas number one artist who recorded a duet version of Crocodile Rock with Elton John for his debut album was, of course, Bob the Builder. Bob the Builder had the Christmas number one in 2000 with Can We Fix It? And then Bob and Elton collaborated on a version of Crocodile Rock as the closing track for Bob the Builder, the album. And this version was also produced by Gus Dudgeon, the producer who did Elton's original in 1972.
He picks them carefully, Elton, doesn't he?
He does. He knows a winner when he sees it. Band-Aid we come to now. Three different versions. Band-Aid 1 in 84, Band-Aid 2 in 89 and Band-Aid 20 in 2004. And the opening lines were sung by Paul Young on the original Band-Aid. The lovely Kylie Minogue in 89 for Band-Aid 2 and the equally lovely Chris Martin for Band-Aid 20 in 2004. The original Band-Aid, Bob and Midge, had asked David Bowie to sing the opening line, but he wasn't available. But he did get to sing it at Live Aid at Wembley in July 85.
I'm just envisaging the listeners sitting there going, it's Christmas time, and trying to imagine whose voice it is.
Yeah.
Well, there's a world outside your window, and it's a world of dread and fear. We hope you've enjoyed the Christmas quiz. The book, the official Christmas number ones book, is out now by Michael Bulligan, and it's under a nice Christmas tree near you.
Thank you very much, Sean. Thank you, Andrew.
Thank you. And that brings us to the end of our first Best of 2021 podcast. Part two will be not next week, but the week after, because we've got a rather special edition next week, have we not, Andrew Harrison?
Yes, we do. We've got an end of season special on the greatest TV show of the moment, Succession, with a rather special guest who is also a Succession addict. Who will it be? Can you guess? You'll have to be near here next week to find out. Also, I'm going to be giving you my suggestions for the Best of 21. Also, I'll be giving you my suggestions for the Best of 2021 at our last show before Christmas on Saturday the 18th of December.
Until then, thanks to Top 24 pop star Jane Weaver. What are you looking forward to in 2022, Jane?
More gigs, please, and festivals, and more recording, just more work.
Have you written an entire album on lockdown without letting on?
No, I haven't, but I need to do another one, I think, soon. So I will get on with that shortly.
Wonderful. We shall look out for it.
And thanks to Anthony Teasdale. What are you looking forward to in 22, Tony?
I'm looking to the increasing domination of the crisp market by Spanish crisps.
Spanish crisps. Why, this is the jamon crisp that we see so often these days.
So there's a big brand called Torres, and they just started to appear. You know, like Tech House appeared. They're just everywhere now. Spanish crisps are really good. And the best ones are the plain ones. They're really thin and they're really salty. And my big secret, I don't tell many people this, always put your crisps in the fridge.
Oh.
For that vending machine freshness.
Ooh. There you go.
I've never heard.
Not just musical tips, but crisp tips too.
And thank you to Michael Mulligan, wherever he may be. Remember, there are only 18 cancelling days left before Christmas. From me, Andrew, producer Alex and assistant producer Yelena, thanks for listening.
The Culture Bunker was written and presented by Andrew Harrison and Sean Pandon. Audio production was by me, Alex Rees. Theme tune by Kenny Dickinson. The Culture Bunker is a Podmasters production.